and all mine are. They lay on top of the hard drive before the operating system partition even kicks in. They take control. They do the decoding from the passwords I set them up with. Then when they get them, they pass the control over to the operating system, whether it's Linux or Windows. So it's an in-between, and Windows or Linux doesn't suffer.
If it is, then that's fine. And that shouldn't tax your main CPU hardly at all. I didn't know there were. I didn't know there were a lot of hard drives that had encryption at the controller level. I suppose I'll look around.
There are, but there are software that will do the same thing. What the software will do is put itself above the boot sector, above the operating system, whether the operating system is Windows or Linux. It'll put itself above there. It'll take care of encrypting the whole drive, pass everything back to itself, ask you what you want everything to be encrypted, give you the options for passcodes, passwords, what have you. If it doesn't enter, it's not going to let any operating system boot up. And what it will do is it will encrypt the whole drive. So if you can't get past it, you're not going to get into any operating system below it. Whether you have a dual boot system, a three boot system, any operating system below it doesn't work.
That's a possibility as well. I'd rather move it down completely to the hardware level, but, you know, that could work as well. You know, also at the hardware level, there's less chance of some kind of side channel attack. You know, plus at the hardware level, I could probably have a drive command that says, delete master key. Set master key to null. And now the entire drive is wiped out in, you know, a tiny fraction of a second.
Thing. That's what you want. When somebody is tampering, trying to get into your hard drive, you want it wiped out. I mean, these things now use AES and every kind of key that you can imagine, think of. And that's what you want, somebody tampering with it that doesn't have permission to tampering with it, and they wipe it out. Only you have the key, only you have the control. Now, if somebody else goes in trying to tamper, that just destroys it. That's the purpose of security.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's the better way to handle security. Well, you know, like the Apple iPhone, I can say, if I say reset everything, part of that is wipe out master key. Okay, well now, you know, you've just rendered all the data useless, and it took you a millisecond to do that.
Finally gotten at the software level for all these major chip-level manufacturers have been for a long time, like, I don't know if you're familiar with microcontrollers, but Atmel, let's see, who are some of the other major ones, Motorola, their microcontrollers or their microcomputers, if you start, the only way you can get anything back is to wipe everything out. Now, you can use the chip again. You can, you know, start from the beginning and use it from scratch, but the only way you're going to make it work is by wiping everything out that was ever put into it. And so that's the steps these software companies have been making now. Yes, you can use a computer, you can use a chip, but you're not going to get any of the software out of it because it has to be wiped out before you can ever use it again. So that's a really good strategy. It works real good.
Atmel, I think, was bought out by Microchip. What happened to them? Yeah, Motorola has features like that built in some of their embedded chips. Actually, a lot of the ARM type processors have a feature like that where there's a you know, a key somewhere in protected storage that you basically can't read. That's the master key used to encrypt everything. I don't know how many other chips that is. It's on the ARM Cortex series, and it's on a lot of the chips that, based on the ARM design that Apple manufactures. Motorola 2, probably. Atmel and Microchip, I'm not sure. I'd have to look that up.
Microchip bought Atmel not too long ago, but Atmel's had, you know, their software and their chips for ages, and you put your designing software in them and you lock it out. And their chips are unusable, you know, after it goes to market, unless you erase everything. Now, you can use their chips. Their chips can be used, again, after they were put out for a specific purpose, but it has to be completely erased before it's usable again. So if somebody tries to pull a chip out to read the code, they're not going to read it. It can't be read. It can't be used again until you completely erase the chip. But after you completely erase the chip, what good is it anyway? Nobody cares. You're not going to get the code out of it. So that's pretty much the way the software companies are beginning to go to with the computers now. And I think the major computer vendors like AMD and all these other chips, that's the way they're going to now.
A Microchip, Atmel, embedded chips like that. Let's see, there's usually a short segment of code. There's a bootloader for the purpose of getting the code into the chip through something like a serial port. I would imagine that you could write a bootloader which reads the code out of the chip and puts it back out the serial port. If I could get things into program memory, there's another instruction to read them out of program memory. But, you know, let's see. There might also be a JTAG interface that'll let me get at it. That'll basically let me snoop over what's going over the data bus. Generally, you know, once the code is in there, you know, you're probably right.
You electronically lock out the Atmel chips. The only way you can ever erase them is through high voltage pulse programming, HPP, high voltage pulse programming. That's the only way to wipe everything out and to be able to use the chip in some other device. Maybe you can pull it out of a board and you saw it and you liked it, but it wipes all the software out, it wipes everything out, it wipes all the factory stuff out. You can use the chip again and can reprogram it for your needs, but you're not going to have the original software that the company put into that chip to begin with. That's the only way you'll ever make that chip work again is to wipe everything out.
Lock bit to lock down program memory. There again, though, in a lot of cases, your program still has to be able to read program memory. If you've got static data stored in program memory, you know, I don't know. I don't know. I don't have that level of familiarity with, like, the Atmel AVR or the Microchip F0 series or whatever it is. I got to get the data sheets out and look at them.
All the microcontrollers from Atmel and Microchip and all those are meant the same way. Once a company or an individual programs their code up into the chip, the fuses will lock everything out. The only way to open the chip back up is to high voltage program them again. And what the high voltage programming does, it wipes all the code, the machine code, out of the chip, opens everything back up, everything's lost, and it's factory new. You can use the chip again, but it wipes everything out and it brings it back to factory.
Which means you wouldn't be able to replace the bootloader in there either. That could work. I gotta get out my Microchip data sheet and look at it again.
built many microcontroller projects using Atmel CPUs and their microcontrollers, and yeah, once you get your what you programmed and got your hard code in them, burn the fuses out, lock them out. The only way anybody will ever get to be able to use it again is to high voltage program it, and when they do, it wipes everything out. Yeah, they can use the chip again, but it's useless. They're not going to get any of the hardware programming out of it.
The JTAG interface for something like an in-circuit emulator, because I would have to be able to pause the code, dump registers out, set breakpoints, and that sort of thing. But I suppose I could lock out that interface as well in the finished, in the completed project.
They're what are called fuses in the chip themselves. So once you finally get done writing your software and uploading it into the computer space, the chip space, you sever the fuses. Once you sever the fuses, it doesn't matter. JTAG, SP programming, it doesn't matter. You're not getting into it. You have to high voltage program it. And what high voltage programming does, it wipes everything out. You can't read anything after the fuses have been locked.
And that would actually work well for a couple of projects I have in mind, where, certain data can't be allowed to leave the chip. I wonder if AVR Studio lets you program the fuse bytes. I gotta get a copy of AVR Studio, because that's probably the only way to do it.
I've got AVR Studio 6. I've got plenty of programming platforms in here. They'll let you lock all the fuses, but make sure you've got all your software in there before you lock it, because once you lock it, it's done, and you're not going to get back into it through AVR Studio. The only way you're going to get back into it is through a high-voltage programming platform, and once you do, it's going to wipe everything out. You can use the chip again, but you're done.
Then I gotta grab a copy of AVR Studio. Because, you know, some of these boards, like the Arduino boards, they use the Atmel AVR chips in a lot of them. And they have that their own IDE programming environment, but they don't really let you mess with things on that level, like the fuse bits. So you need, you know, the actual programming tools.
You will see. I'm trying to figure out what the tool I have here. I haven't used it in a long time. Hold on just a minute. I think I've got the MK. No, what is that? Hold on a minute. Just a minute and I'll tell you what the tool I have. I haven't used it in a long time. Hold on just a minute and I'll tell you what the tool I have is. Yeah. My tool is the JTAG IS3. The IS3. And I've actually got my IS3 plugged into my Arduino board, so I can plug my 328s and program everything I want into the 328s. I can write my own C software code. I don't have to use the Arduino code. I can pull that chip out, plug it into my own boards, make my own boards around the 328 microprocessor, and do whatever I want to. But yeah, JTAG 3.
Programmer do I need? Obviously, that's not going to be through SP1 or through the serial port. It's going to have to access the programming line, and let me see if I can remember what I need to do here.
JTAG 3 programmer, get you an Arduino Uno board, do a little jumping on it, plug it into Arduino's ISP port. You can actually program the 328 with pure C, or you can use C++, whatever programming language you like, but I program in pure C. Program that thing in pure C, you can pull that chip out, make your own board around it to do whatever you want to, and away you go. You can make your own custom boards, your own custom software, you can lock the chip out, you can program the fuses, nobody can get into it and steal your code. It works really good.
I'll look into that. because I have an idea for something that uses public key encryption and digital signing to guarantee the authenticity of certain data. And that private key has to be in the chip in such a way that nobody can read it. We defeat the whole purpose.
That you may have to pass back and forth between the bootloader and your actual user code, I think is what you're trying to do. You can actually separate this chip between either boot and user code or just only user code and use the chip wide open. You can use these chips either way. You can let them have a boot code, and you can actually program whatever you want in the boot code to kick the user code in afterwards, or you can use the whole chip just for user code. If you're wanting security, write your own boot code to kick in the user code in the chip. If you're wanting a lot of security, write your own user code for the boot code, let it kick in the user code. It's a long, drawn-out process. It really is.
Yeah, but that's all right. Yeah, so I'd have to design my own bootloader, or I'd have to, because as I said, without revealing the details of anything, it's a project involving public key encryption, specifically digital signatures, and, you know, the private key is going to have to be stored somewhere in program space, let's say, in such a way that, you know, it's impossible to read out of the thing. Otherwise, if you could read the private key, obviously, through some means, obviously you've compromised the whole thing. But I can tell you what the project is, if you're interested.
Atmel, you can't exchange information from user code to boot code. I don't think you can do that. You can do it one way from boot code to user code, but for security reasons, user code won't let you pass it back to boot code. So it's going to have to be a one-way encryption type of thing to get what you're talking about to work. It won't let you pass it back and forth, because if you could pass codes back from user space to boot code, anybody could get in, decipher it, hack it, you know, disassemble it, do whatever. So the chip won't let you pass it back and forth. It'll let it go one way, from boot code to user code. It's not going to let you go the other way. So you're going to have to implement whatever you want in user code after the boot code gets done, and then lock the boot code out.
What I'm thinking. But, yeah, it's an idea I've been kicking around for a while. But it depends on the possibility of, you know, there's static data in the form of, let's say, private keys that can't ever be allowed to get outside. Otherwise, you've compromised the system.
That's the whole thing, keeping the system secured. But, yeah, I mean, Atmel has a really good platform. They always have. I haven't ever figured out why they sold out to Microchip, because Microchip's, what was that thing they had, those chips they had? I never cared anything about those things. PICs, yeah. Microchip PICs. I didn't like the PICs, never did. They just weren't flexible, so I don't know why Atmel ever sold to them. It's beyond me, because they had a really good product. But anyway, yeah, I've used Atmel's for years.
Microsoft PIC series. It was, I know exactly the ones. Yeah, they were somewhat limited. I was never impressed with, I agree with you as far as, and why did Microchip buy them out? I don't know. That's the way it goes in the semiconductor industry. Sometimes it's a question of I got a good product but a lousy cash flow.
Yeah, because the pick controllers were never anything. I looked into them. I did look into them. I tried to program them. I tried to see what their capabilities were, and those pick chips were just not. Those things were meant for hobbyists, not serious hobbyists. Those were for people that wanted to make these little toys that could go on and do this and make. No, they weren't for serious people. Atmel has some really good stuff, but like I said, why they sold out to Microchip, I have no idea.
Now I know what product was based around that chip. What happened to Basic Stamp? Microchip had some version of their PIC controller that had a basic interpreter built into it, which is, you know, makes it easy to write user code. It's easy to program your own, you know, a bit on the slow side, but Basic Stamp was one of the microcontrollers I remember. It was geared toward the hobbyist type of programmer.
Stamp did the same thing that the other microcontroller companies tried to do too. Basic Stamp tried to use controllers from other vendors, but used Basic as the language to be able to program them. And I did have a couple Basic Stamp microcontrollers and boards, but Basic is just a very limited language to program a computer in. That was the very first thing beginners come out with. It's not very flexible. You can't do anything with it. You can play with it. If you're not serious and you just want to play and have a little bit of fun, yeah, the Basic Stamp will work for that. If you want to run servos, if you want to play with this and that and the other, then, and if you're new to it, the Basic Stamp will work for that, yeah. But it's not for serious programmers or serious software engineers. It's just not geared to that. But, Basic Stamp, yeah, for beginners, it's just like the Arduino. The Arduino draws in everybody that's new to microprogrammers. That's what the Basic Stamp is doing. The Arduino uses the C language. Well, it's a subset of the C language. They call that, what does Arduino call that? C something or other. They make their own language to use chips just as a selling point, but they're only good for their own platforms.
Because that was another one. What do they call it? It's based on C. They don't call them programs, they call them sketches. But what do they call the language? It's pretty close to straight C. It's got a few extensions to it. Yeah, I can't remember what they call it.
Your Arduino uses wiring C. Yeah, wiring C. It's not pure C. It's not C++, C++, or anything like that. It's called wiring. And it doesn't teach you how to program in C. Whereas if you get away from the other stuff, you can learn actual C programming. And you can't even learn even basic programming with the basic module.
Well, I don't know. I did C on Unix for a lot of years. It's close enough to C. You can learn programming. Well, if you need to be closer to the actual hardware to do things like what we're discussing, be able to lock out program space, then no, you can't do it with that. You need to be right at the level of the hardware. Then I guess go get the Atmel Visual Studio or whatever version they got out now.
Everybody has to start somewhere, but if you want to be able to program at any chip hardware level, you're going to have to learn how to see, program in C, and there are so many ports of C for so many computers, so many microprocessors that will let you get to the hardware level, hardware programming, that, yeah, it's great. C is a great language to learn for hardware programming.
that's the efficiency of the language is what makes it so dangerous. I'm sure you know as well as I do, 1,001 ways to kill yourself at sea. But, you know, it is very, very efficient. Translates to very, very nice, tight assembly code. And, you know, it's a real language.
But at the same time, it's your responsibility to clean up after yourself, because it's not going to do it like these high-level programming languages will do. They'll clean up your mess and not tell you what they cleaned up. It's your responsibility to allocate memory, deallocate it, clean up your own mess, do what you have to do to make the chip run good. You have to be an actual hardware programmer to UC, because when you mess up one time in anything, you're cooked. It's done.
No, that's what I did for quite a few years. And, you know, as far as the 100 most common sea mistakes that'll very quickly, you know, I probably haven't seen half of them. And, you know, I've seen quite a few. But, yeah, you know, the reason it is so efficient is the same reason it is so dangerous.
That's why I like the language. It leaves everybody to do what they should do, but it leaves the flexibility to the programmer. They have all the power. They can do anything they want to do at the hardware level. Any bit they want to manipulate, any word they want to manipulate is there, but at a cost. Now, if you know how to deal with that cost, you're good to go. If you don't, and you want somebody else to clean up your mess, that's where C-sharp, all those other high-level programming languages come in, if you can't deal with that.
Never dealt with. C++, try to somewhat avoid when possible, but, you know, then on the other hand, the other language, you know, it's a trade-off between, would you be willing to accept less efficiency if the language did more for you? 20, 30 years ago, maybe not, but in the case where I've got machine cycles to burn, if something's not the most efficient, that may not matter either.
C and C++ are the exact same languages. The only difference between the two is between classes and structs. That's it. C has structs and C++ has classes. And that's the only difference. You have to clean up after yourself the same way. Everything works the same way. Your subroutines, everything works the exact same way. It's just the way the language is laid out. But C and C++ work the exact same way. Structs are what's in C, and classes is in what's C++.
Structure only specifies data format. Class also specifies methods, which are used to manipulate that data. You know, the thing I don't like about it is supposedly by encapsulating methods and data, you're making something that's reusable and easier to, you know, to me you're creating a mess. I think of something like Microsoft frustration classes, where I've got to wade through this huge class hierarchy to figure out, maybe it's just me. Maybe I'm a classy person, but I'd just rather deal with C.
Some way, I love C. C++ was the first venture into high-level programming, where it tried to separate the programmer and try to keep it so abstract that they didn't have to deal with the hardware level. But, yeah. pretty much, though, C and C++, the only difference is, like I said, classes and all that other stuff.
It's usually implemented as a preprocessor anyway. It takes your C++ nice-looking code and turns it into really, really an ugly, nasty-looking C code, and then throws it to the C compiler to compile it. And if you want an example of how something that gets translated into something really ugly, think about C++ exceptions. You know, try and catch. If anything in the try portion of it fails, it goes to the catch portion. Well, let me think how that's probably implemented. Can you say go to?
You shouldn't use go to in any language. I don't care whether it's basic, C, C++. No programmer should use the go-to keyword anyway. But, C++ did try to throw everything at a higher level. But for me, C is just the way to go.
You shouldn't use a statement like go-to. But I'm saying, maybe I'm wrong. But, C++ exception handling, I'd really like to see how that gets rewritten by the preprocessor before the C compiler grabs it. Exception handling, if any one of these things fails, execute this code here. How much you want to bet the way that that's actually implemented is there's a label and a go-to statement. If I find a way to bring up a C++ compiler and turn off the, see if there's some compiler switch that says run the preprocessor and then stop, I bet you'll see some nasty looking C code.
Exception handling is your responsibility. You're supposed to be thinking what could happen here. That is what exception handling is. You're supposed to be thinking, okay, if this appliance does this, if this piece of equipment does this, if this user does this, then what do we do? How do we do that? How do we compensate for this? That's called exceptions. That's exception handling. It's your responsibility to write exception handling code. Now, interrupts, as far as chip-wise goes, is a totally different thing. Now, interrupts, exception handling for interrupts is as far as what you program for the system and the chips you put in place. Software handling, hardware handling, they're both exception handling, but they're totally two different things.
About what C++ calls exception handling, which the non-lazy way of doing it is having a dozen nested if-then-else statements. But in C++, you can put everything as a try and catch. Catch basically is where you branch to if anything in the block above would have generated an error. So it's the lazy person's way of checking for errors. If anything fails, jump here.
That's basic exception, user exception handling, Those are things you have to think up as a software engineer. And, you have to try to catch what a user will do that they're not supposed to do, what you think they will interact with your chips, your components, that's exception handling. So what you have to do is you have to come up in your mind on a drawing board, what if this user does this? Well, if they do this, then you need to do this. That's exception handling. You're handling what somebody else has done they weren't supposed to do. Or you have to handle what a computer did that you meant for it to do that it didn't do. So now it didn't do this. But you have to go along the lines and think up, okay, this computer did this, I didn't want it to. Okay, that's an exception, I want to do this. This computer did this, well, that's an exception, this is not what I meant it to do, I want to do this. that exception handling. You handle every circumstance that was not meant in the original programming or design of the system.
Aspects of the language that I do happen to like. I like the idea of constructor functions. Just to make sure that nothing ever out there doesn't get initialized properly. Let's see, I like the idea of default parameters. You know, whatever parameters I don't specify at the end of the list when I'm calling a function, get default values. And I do kind of like the idea, even though it can get very confusing, I like the idea of function overloading. You know, this function has the same name, but takes different parameters, you know, depending upon what I'm passing to it. So, in that sense, it makes things a little easier. And then, you know, there's other aspects of the languages that are just, you know, I don't know. It's kind of like, you know, let's try to make a bus fly by putting wings on it. You know, not optimal.
Function overloading is to be able to create a function that was for your own use outside of what the original language was designed for. But the original language will accommodate you to do. That's what function overloading is. Yeah, I mean, C is really powerful on the hardware level. And because so many compilers have been wrote for so many microprocessors, so many microcontrollers, you can get right down there at the hardware level. But yeah, C programmers, man, they have all the power at their disposal. Problem is, it's their job to clean up their mess. I mean, that's the responsibility that comes with having that power of being able to control every aspect of every chip, every memory location, every spot, everything that was designed into a system. It's your job to clean up your own mess that you can't do with high-level programming languages. High-level programming languages will clean that up for you, but you don't have the flexibility either. You just can't get right in there.
And it's just a different philosophy. I did C and Unix for many years. Now, that doesn't sound like an especially, oh, Unix, C, that's real boring. You know, you should be doing Windows and Java and whatever else, the latest trend or whatever it is. But you know what? The basic meat and potatoes. C and Unix run the internet, basically. The back end to pretty much anything is. So you got to see good C and Unix person. Those people are still very much in demand.
But the guy that can control every data output, every address input, and knows how every chip works with every other chip in whatever system he's trying to design works, that's the one you really want.
I suppose that's true. Although hardware changes even faster than... I don't know that many real good hardware people. Good hardware person that really understands things at that level, they're valuable as well.
Using C language, the C language we're talking about, if you can understand that the C language you use to program every chip compiled to the control, if you can understand what you are doing with that piece of software is, you are turning off every data line. You are turning on and off every hardware address, which means you are turning off every other chip. Okay?
when that processor is tight, you are turning everything on and off. You are triggering every chip that was built into that system through that processor that you are programming through C. If you know heart level programming, yes, it's awesome.
Radio check, thank you.
I was talking to just screwed the static.
You're kind of staticky. I'm on a handheld in Pacoa doing a little experimentation to see if I could hit the Greenville repeater from here.
Well enough, sounds good.
Following your guys' conversation, beforehand. By the way, I'm a Linux guy. So I'll let y'all continue on. Thank you. KD4HLC.
KD2BNG. I don't know. I got an antenna connector. The cat must have snagged an antenna connector. Because one of us disappeared to the noise.
Still hear you. Seems the other party's dropped out. KD4HLC.
Okay, so the other station disappeared into a puff of static. Because this antenna has been, you know, I wonder if the cats keep chewing the antenna cable.
That's a weird day. Probably got thunderstorms moving through right now as they move through about an hour or two ago here. Or heavy rain, not necessarily thunderstorms.
Sometimes happens too with this repeater. Because there's like 400 feet of feed line going up that tower, and it starts blowing around, and it hits against the tower. Today the repeater seems mostly okay.
My handle's Scott. I'm in Tacoma, Georgia.
You're a good distance away, so if that's a handheld, I guess it's doing fine.
Just getting back into it. Off this little shiny something other, and I put what they call a tiger tail on it, as I've tried to check into the net a few times, and it's been spotty. But apparently, there's a little something to this.
It's a little pigtail. Take off the rubber ducky antenna and plug it into a good antenna. And you can actually do very, very, very well with a handheld. You sound fine now. And, you know, you're a considerable distance away.
I'm away. All right. Enjoyed all the computer talk. Like I say, I've been a Linux guy since about 1999.
Yeah, no, that's my background is Unix and C, mini and mainframe, well not mainframe, you know, larger size, you know, like server systems. The whole back end that makes the data actually flow, that's kind of the important part. C and Unix is kind of what runs the whole internet.
I'm not an expert with it. Kind of low Linux because it's kind of rock stable. It got something spinning up going on. Find the right file to edit it, save it, and usually don't have no more problems.
That's why I don't usually run Windows as one of my primary operating systems. You know, I like the stability of, you know, Linux. Linux / Unix, you know, been around a long, long time. It's always been relatively stable, relatively secure. never was that impressed with anything Microsoft did. So that's what's running most of these computers. You know, these are just desktop machines.
Microsoft makes me want to vomit.
I don't know what's happening. Did your antenna, your cable come loose?
Coffee's been fired. Plant the antenna down, and you're kind of getting a little catchy in yourself. It's probably, I imagine, the brain system is probably about to be repaired right now.
This does that. Oh, wait, what's happening to me now? I'm losing my transmit here.
Well, I thank you for everything. I can file it.
You have a good one. This is Kilo Delta 2 Bravo November Golf. I'm sure I already forgot your call sign. But 73s, you have a good day.
Four CBA Mobile.